I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. The war in Afghanistan is brought home in a candid new book, Fob Doc, A Doctor on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. It's a compelling diary kept by Captain Ray Wiss, MD, who rejoined the Canadian forces in the summer of 2007 to support the mission in Afghanistan. Beginning in November 2007, for the next 3 months, he spent nearly his entire tour in combat treating the severe injuries of Canadians and Afghans. We read of his trying to cope with the terror and boredom of frontline soldier life. There are also over 100 photographs in the book from his time in combat, as well as the men and women on all sides of this war. All royalties from the publication of this book will be donated to the Military Families Fund, which was founded by General Rick Hillier, the former Chief of Defense Staff, who writes the foreword to this book. Published by Douglas and McIntyre, Fob Doc is a tremendous book, sometimes heartbreaking, sometimes hilarious, but always riveting, human, and real. It's a necessary view onto this conflict that is sometimes hard to understand, but one that's on the minds of a lot of Canadians. Please welcome to the Planta Online program Dr. Ray Wiss. Good morning, Captain Wiss.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I want to talk about your background before we talk about the book. What was first, the career in medicine or military?
Well, I was an infantry officer when I was much younger, so I was in the combat arms when I was in my early 20s. Sometime after I got out of that, I did that for 4.5 years, I went into medicine, specialized in emergency medicine. I went on to be an emergency physician for a decade before I reapproached the Canadian forces in the spring of 07, specifically to volunteer for the mission in Afghanistan. I asked them if they needed the help of someone like myself, ex-infantry and with emergency medicine skills and trauma team leader skills. They said yes. 4 months later, I was re-enrolled, and 2 months after that, I was on Hercules aircraft headed for Kandahar.
Now, you're still a member of the reserves, right?
I am. Yes, I just returned from my second tour in Afghanistan, and I remain a member of the reserves.
And the second tour, we see the end, the beginning of it at the end of the book.
Yes.
How long was that, 3 months?
No, it was 4 months.
4 months. Now, if you're a member of the reserves, how does that work? Do you get called back at all?
You have a fair degree of control over that. It's a voluntary position, and so they ask you to come, and you have to agree to go. It's quite different from being a regular Army soldier.
Now, you practice medicine in Sudbury, right?
I do. I'm an emergency specialist there, yes.
Yeah. FOB, FOB, Field Operations Base.
Forward Operating Base.
Pardon me, Forward Operating. Yeah. That's the front line, right?
That is. The war in Afghanistan is an insurgency war, so there's no front line as there would have been, say, in World War One or World War Two. But clearly, there are areas where the Taliban are much stronger and where they have a strong presence, and that's where we put these small combat outposts, what we call FOBs or forward operating bases, and that's where we fight from, and this is where the fighting actually goes on. From the two FOBs that I served at in the book, they're built on heights of land that allow us to dominate the terrain militarily, but you can see from the top of either one of these FOBs where approximately 85% to 90% of the Canadians who've died in Afghanistan have met their end. It's a very intimate little war like that.
And how many people are in, how many troops in the sort are you with?
A couple hundred.
Yeah. And what equipment do you bring as a doctor?
Well, the Canadian Forces has done a remarkable job, I think, over the past 25 years of enhancing its medical capabilities. And from the point of injury all the way through to the surgical hospital at the main base at Kandahar, Canadian soldiers who are wounded today get remarkable medical care. What, if you look at the intermediate step there, which is the FOB, the little unit medical station that I work at, I've got pretty much everything I would have in a level one trauma center in the resuscitation rooms. There's pretty much everything that I can do in my resus room, I can do there. I can put in breathing tubes into people's lungs, into their mouths if they still have a mouth, or through their neck if they don't. I can put tubes into their chest to drain off excessive bleeding that might be crushing their heart or their lungs. I can start IVs, give them oxygen, spark their heart with defibrillators. I can do any number of things like that that keep them alive for that first half hour until the chopper comes along to take them to the surgical hospital at the main base at Kandahar.
And then do you have equipment like, I saw you on the news a couple weeks ago, with ultrasound technology?
Yeah. Well, the thing I'm better known for, at least until recently, was not my service in Afghanistan, but the fact that over the past 8 years, I designed Canada's National Emergency Ultrasound course and then took it on the road. And myself and the teams that I've trained have taught approximately 5,000 Canadian physicians how to use, Canadian emergency physicians how to use ultrasound, pretty much making it the standard of care and to a certain degree transforming the way we practice emergency medicine in Canada today. So having used it for, at that point, the better part of a decade, I felt naked going without it. So I actually dragged my own little ultrasound machine with me on that first tour. And as you will read in the book, it had quite an impact on the lives of some soldiers. And so the Canadian Forces did take notice of that, and I'm happy to say that all of the doctors who went on the last tour, the one that just got back with me in September, October, all of them had been trained by me in the use of ultrasound. In fact, three of them had been trained to an advanced instructor level. And for those three, I was able to get a company to donate basic ultrasound machines, like the one in the book, for use at the forward operating bases where they would be working.
I'm sure as you cross the country talking about this book and talking to people, reading from it and the sort, there are people who don't understand the fact that you also treated Taliban, right?
Yeah, that always surprises me. You know, I've been asked by CBC reporters and others, you know, would you really treat Taliban prisoners? Well, of course I would. You know, and for a number of reasons. First, this is, I think, a moral war. And if we're going to win this war, we're going to win it because our ideas are more appealing than those of our enemies to human beings. And one of those ideas is that we treat our prisoners humanely, regardless of the unbelievably brutal way that the Taliban treat their prisoners, which is tends to be torture, medieval torture, which leads to the prisoner's death within 24 hours. And I've been parts of groups that have found the bodies of Afghan soldiers have been kidnapped by the Taliban, and I know that's exactly the case. But there's another reason to treat your prisoners humanely, and that's not only is it moral warfare, it's smart warfare. If you treat your prisoners inhumanely, you can count on them fighting harder rather than getting captured the next time they're around. And if you treat them humanely, they realize that you're not the monsters their leaders have told them that we are. Whenever we would capture a Taliban, the process was always the same. They'd be terrified initially, and then they gradually would relax as they saw that we were doing our very best to save their lives and to patch up their wounds. And I would always make a point when before we would send them on to Kandahar for their surgical treatment and admittedly eventual imprisonment, to tell them that we were Canadians, that we had done right by them, even though they were wounded and even though they were the enemy. And I know that some of them have gone on afterwards and turned 180 degrees right around and informed on their former Taliban colleagues. Now, that was on my first tour. Interestingly enough, our reputation for treating prisoners humanely, although it seems to not have penetrated into Canada, because I do get that question fairly often, it certainly has penetrated into the Taliban leadership. And on a couple of occasions, we found wounded Taliban soldiers who had been placed in the path of our convoys precisely because they knew that we would take good care of them. You know, they tried to patch them up, weren't able to for whatever reason. And so they drag them right onto the road where they know we're going to find them. And they tell the guys to relax because these are Canadians and they'll take good care of you. So it's interesting that the Taliban seem to have a clear idea that we treat our prisoners humanely, even though some Canadians do not.
It's just amazing, an amazing story. This diary that you kept, how did you keep it? Was it a book? Was it electronically?
It was strictly a series of emails that I was sending home to family and friends to let them know what I was doing. I had no intention of writing a book when I was there. And because I sent it home by email, it got out and was read by a lot more people than I ever intended it to be read by, one of them being General Rick Hillier. And all of these senior people in the Canadian Forces and others encouraged me to publish it because they felt I'd done a good job of explaining the mission, why we were there. And indeed, the most common response I would get from friends of mine who would be reading the diary as I was writing it from Afghanistan was, I had no idea. I didn't know that. It's not that I'm talking about stuff that's top secret or unheard of. It's just that the life of the Canadian soldier on the front lines and our successes, the things that are going well, get reported very rarely in the media. they just don't seem to make the headlines the way our deaths and the things that are going wrong make the headlines. So it was, it gave, I think, the whole mission some context and some balance that people were happy to read about.
So, do you blame the media that we as Canadians don't get a sense of what's going on there, or why we're there especially?
Well, I think blame is perhaps too strong a word, but here's the thing. Every article that mentions one of our dead always gives the total. Certainly, if you look at the CBC website, it's always like that. That makes it 131, 132, now 133 Canadians dead in Afghanistan. But that number is never followed by the number that gives the first number context, and that is that under the Taliban, there were 600,000 students in all of Afghanistan, of whom 12,000 were girls. In 2007, those numbers were now 6 million students, of whom 1.2 million were girls. You know, we can't win this war on the battlefield. If we do win, there will still be Taliban in Afghanistan, just like there are still Nazis in Germany. But we will win it in the Afghan classroom by educating the Afghan population. But what happens, and so that's the success story, and that's the most evident success story in Afghanistan. But if that gets written once, say on the 1st of January, on the 2nd of January, if that same reporter wants to write a story about Afghanistan, well, he can't write a story that says, you know, those 6 million kids were in school yesterday? They're still in school. His editor will spike that story in a hurry. The good news stories are more incremental like that, and if you read every single article that comes out, you will find them. You will read them, but they just don't get repeated enough to penetrate the Canadian mindset. And I don't think you can blame the media per se, because you can't repeat the same story over and over again. That's not the way things work. I think it's just a function of the way mass media works.
And we lose sight of the fact that the Afghan people, for all the differences in religion and geography, we're essentially still all the same. That's what I got out of the book.
Oh, are we ever? You know, what Canadians don't realize a lot is that we're on one side of a civil war here, a civil war that was going on before we got there, and that continues to this day. And that civil war pits the Taliban and their supporters, who are in a small minority, but a very determined minority in Afghanistan, against a large majority who are anti-Taliban or would like to be left alone, but the Taliban won't leave them alone. That's really what we're doing. We're supporting one side of a civil war, and the people on our side certainly are extraordinarily like us. They want their kids to get an education, they'd like to get a job, they'd like to be at peace, and hopefully one day we'll be able to give them all those things.
Do you think people here in Canada who oppose our being there, do you think they've got a point? I mean, when they say we should pull out now, as opposed to what the timeline is, do you think they get it?
Well, I think a lot of the opposition to the war is based on a lack of information. And certainly a lot of the people that I talk to since coming back from Afghanistan say things like, well, you know, I didn't understand that, I didn't know that. Or they'll say things like, well, I'm against war. Well, that's a bit of a cop-out. My position is not that I'm pro-war. I'm not for war. I'm for protecting Afghan civilians from what the Taliban was doing to them and continues to do to them to this day in terms of their abuses. I think there's a lot of that soft opposition to the war, which is, as I said, based on a lack of information. I think that some of that opposition is just easy because it's, you know, it's something that's far away and doesn't affect us. But I think it does affect us, and we have to become global citizens. Now, having said that, there are some people on the anti-mission, if you want to call it that, not anti-war, but anti-mission side of the fence, who raise valid points. And some very good friends of mine, oppose the mission. We have interesting debates. But virtually all of their arguments, if you look at the arguments that we are having, are arguments that I think miss the key point. The key point that I think that this is a moral war. And a moral war is defined not by whether we're going to win and who's there with us, but by our enemies. Have our enemies gone so far into immorality that it has become moral to wage war against them? you look at the points that the people who are opposed to the war make, they tend to be things like, well, look at who's there with us. You know, we're uncomfortable with our American or Afghan allies. We don't find them to be upstanding and the best kinds of allies. But I would remind people who say that, that our allies against the Nazis was the Soviet Union under Stalin. I mean, arguably a worse mass murdering regime than the Nazis were. It was nonetheless appropriate for us to ally ourselves with Stalin's Russia to defeat the Nazis because we had to get rid of them. And once we were done with them, then we could oppose the Soviet Union afterwards. Some people wonder whether we're ever going to win. Again, to those folks, I would say, if this is a moral war, then it's one we need to fight, and one that we will win for the same reason that we defeated the Nazis and later the communists in the Cold War, because this is a war of ideas, and our ideas are more appealing than those of our enemies.
The men and women that you were with in Afghanistan, the troops, the forces, do you find that they think about the mission in terms of how long we should stay there and whether it is winnable?
Well, the vast majority, and I mean, we're not a monolithic, you know, force at all. I know that no army in a democracy ever is.
Right.
You know, the vast majority support the mission, support the goals, and understand that. I mean, a lot of them are young, and they have trouble articulating it, I find, in a very coherent way, but they just feel it in their guts that this is just wrong, what's going on. You know, I had one trooper this past summer when I was there who lost a very close friend to a mine early in the tour and spent a month after that thinking that he couldn't find a reason that justified him losing his friend. And then he was on a patrol, and took over a town that had been held by the Taliban for some time, and found a young boy with a bad leg fracture that hadn't been set properly, hadn't been set at all, because the Taliban had refused to allow the child to go to the government-run health center in the government-controlled area of the district. And now this kid will never walk properly. And the trooper saw that, and all he could say to me was, well, this kid didn't ask to be born here. And that made it all make sense to him, why he was there. So they think in that terms, the troops think in those terms, they think about the fact that they do support the mission. And do they wonder if we're going to win? You know, I wonder if we're going to win. They do too. They certainly hope we will. But it's a war where, you know, none of us are going to know until it's over. But, you know, again, put that in context. June 6th, in the morning of June 6th, 1944, D-Day went in. 175,000 Allied soldiers hit the beaches. And we take that for granted now. Oh, yeah, D-Day, that's when we invaded Europe. It was such a near-run thing. Had there been a couple of breaks that went the other way, those guys would have all ended up dead or in prisoner of war camps, and the world would look very different today. And we forget that. We forget that Eisenhower wrote a press statement before the mission started, in case he had to address the press to explain that the invasion had failed. And we forget all that. This is a war. Of course, we can't predict the future. And they worry about that because they are the ones who have suffered the most in terms of the sacrifices they've made and the friends they've lost.
We hear all the time, if you follow the American media, we hear all the time of these horror stories of soldiers coming back and, you know, traumatic brain injuries and certain misdiagnosed or ignored. Increased levels of post-traumatic stress disorder amongst troops, whether they're American or Canadian. How are we treating our soldiers here in Canada when they come back?
Well, first of all, I think we're treating them quite well, but the next thing we need to understand is the reason we're treating them quite well, which goes to your first statement, which I really have to disagree with. There aren't increased rates of PTSD. It's kind of like child abuse. We're talking about it now.
Yeah.
You know, were there any stories about PTSD after World War II? No. Was there PTSD? There had to be. There's just no way those guys all came back psychically intact. So there had to be there. It had to be there, but we just didn't talk about it. We hid it away in long-term psychiatric institutions, and we just didn't talk about it. The same way we never used to talk about child abuse. And some people have the misguided idea that there's more of that going around. I can't believe that. I don't think the human race has changed, you know, in our time. What has changed is that we're much more honest and much more forthcoming about these kinds of things. And so we know what happens to our soldiers when they come back. We know that 6% of them will have some form of PTSD, and of that, one-third will get better entirely on their own. One-third will get better with therapy, completely better. And one-third will struggle long-term. But they'll struggle in a context that's quite supportive of that diagnosis. I mean, I had to repatriate, which means send back home a couple of guys over my two tours who just weren't functioning anymore. And, you know, they weren't particularly given a hard time about that. You know, they were expected to be soldiers to a point. And then when it was clear that they could no longer be, then, you know, they were given pretty competent and caring mental health care. I mean, we deploy psychologists, not the MD psychiatrists, but we deploy psychologists and social workers right up to the FOBs. I mean, they don't spend their whole time there like I did, but they certainly do come and visit, and they will interact with the troopers who are having the hardest time and give them quite good mental health care.
The diary that you'd kept over there and the book that we see now, how did that change? Did it change a great deal?
No. No, well, it's longer. Nothing so much changed. There's about 25% more material, just because as I went through the editing process, I just remembered more stuff. And as I said, I didn't go there to write a book, so there were any number of days where I didn't feel like writing. You know,
yeah.
I thought, I'm just going to lay around and not trouble myself with this. And so as I started to write, started to go through the editing process after the publisher had agreed to go for it, I just remembered more things and included those extra chapters. I added the entire epilogue that comes after my return and up to my departure for my second tour. All of that stuff would be new. And that's about it. I had to run it by the operational security people to make sure I wasn't giving away anything that might help our enemies. But their changes were so small. You'd have to read the original diary and the other books side by side to be able to detect where they changed anything. It was all pretty minor stuff. I mean, I'd been careful myself, knowing that I was emailing at home. I wasn't. Certainly was trying not to give away anything. But but you could see that the guys from the operational security branch, or the individual who was reading it, was doing his best to get as much of the story out there as possible, even suggesting ways to just reword a sentence or two to make it a little bit vaguer.
The reaction to the book has been quite good. Is that gratifying to you as the author?
Well, sure it is. You know, any neophyte first-time author is obviously, it feels like you've got your little baby out there. And yeah, it's the best-selling purely military book on Amazon.ca right now. It's the best title in the Douglas and McIntyre, I don't know what you call it, stable, I guess.
Yeah, the catalog, yeah.
So the catalog. So yeah, it's doing quite well, and I'm obviously quite pleased about that. Yeah, it's, I think, the most common response I got from folks who read my emails, and these were, you know, folks who were pretty with it, you know, well-off doctors who had access to all the media they want, and almost all of them living in large centers. Now, the most common response I got was, I had no idea. I didn't understand that. I didn't know that. And so I'm glad that the message is getting out there, that knowledge is getting out there. And, of course, I'm pleased, you know, all the royalties, as you pointed out, all of my profits from this are going to the Military Families Fund. I'm not making a nickel off of this, but this is something that means a great deal to me. And so that is gratifying as well.
I'm sure you're asked this all the time. I know you're asked this all the time.
Let me guess. Am I going to go back?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I do get asked that all the time. I don't know. This second one was a lot harder on my daughter. She was 2 the first time, 4 for the second one. You know, there were a lot of phone, you know, satellite phone calls with her saying, Daddy, Afghanistan is too long. And that was hard. I don't know. If the Canadian Forces came calling again, would I go back a third time? You know, my wife, incredibly, has already said if I need to do this again that she would support me. She spontaneously said that the day I got back, which led me to wonder just how good a time she had while I was gone, of course. But no, she's just the saint. And she knew who I was when she married me, so none of this really surprised her. But I'm concerned about my daughter. I don't think I left any lasting damage with this second tour, but I think I may have come close, and I'm not sure I want to ever dance on that line again. So I don't know. I'd have to make a pretty good pitch.
Dr. Wyss, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and read this book. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Fob Doc, A Doctor on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. Do pick this up. This is just a necessary book. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Captain Ray Wyss, MD, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.